Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Uncensored Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde. Edited by Nicholas Frankel. Narrated by Eduardo Ballerini. Preface. Oscar Wilde's typescript of his only novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, remained unpublished until 2011, when it appeared under the title The Picture of Dorian Gray, an annotated, uncensored edition, as part of Harvard University Press's annotated series of classic literary works. Like The Picture of Dorian Gray, an annotated, uncensored edition, this paperback edition is based on the typescript submitted by Wilde to Lippincott's Monthly Magazine in 1890, whereupon an alarmed J.M. Stoddart, the magazine's editor, quickly determined the novel, at least in its present form, would offend the sensibilities of his readership. Especially troubling to Wilde's editor were instances of graphic sexual, especially homosexual, content he found in the typescript. In consultation with his publishing associates, Stoddart struck words, phrases, and whole sentences from Wilde's typescript. The introductory essays that follow explain the commercial, social, and legal imperatives that motivated changes to both Wilde's typescript and the subsequent and expanded book edition of 1891, published by Ward, Locke, and Company. This edition restores all of the material excised by Stoddart and his colleagues. Literary scholars often speak of publication as a process of collaboration between publishers and authors. However, the reality is often far different. The relations between Victorian journal editors and their authors presumed a sharp imbalance of power, especially where first-time novelists were involved. Thomas Hardy complained in 1890 that the patrons of literature, no longer peers with a taste, acting under the censorship of prudery, rigorously exclude from the pages they regulate subjects that have been made, the basis of the finest imaginative compositions since literature rose to the dignity of an art. In the case of Wilde's novel, the evidence that Stoddart censored it is plain from the sexual and political nature of his deletions, such as his removal of Basil Hallward's confession, "There was love for Dorian in every line of the portrait, and in every touch there was passion." Further evidence can be found in Stoddart's panicked reaction upon receipt of Wilde's typescript. "Rest assured that it will not go into the magazine unless it is proper that it shall," he told his employer, Craig Lippincott. "In its present condition, there are a number of things which an innocent woman would make an exception to. But I will go beyond this and make it acceptable to the most fastidious taste." Before committing himself to publication, Stoddart assigned Wilde's typescript to no fewer than 5 publishing professionals for comment, one of whom he later charged with picking out any objectionable passages. Wilde did not see these changes to his novel until after it appeared in print. American literary critic Elaine Showalter has characterized the milieu in which Wilde lived and wrote as one of sexual anarchy. Stoddart's edits must be seen within the wider context of the sexual paranoia and legal threat apparent in the late 1880s and early 1890s. The circumstances under which Dorian Gray was published are a far cry from those faced by the majority of English-language authors either before or since. The 1885 Criminal Law Amendment Act, outlawing gross indecency between men. The establishment of the National Vigilance Association in 1885. It successfully brought about a jail sentence for Henry Vizetelly, translator of Emile Zola's works, in 1889. And the Cleveland Street scandal of 1889 to 1890 all served to bring about a heightened atmosphere of paranoia and intolerance, particularly where upper-class and well-educated English homosexuals were concerned. Indeed, Wilde was the chief victim of this climate of repression, as was plain from the jubilation that greeted his imprisonment for gross indecency in 1895. Whether he acknowledged it or not, Stoddart's hand was directed by the courts. Literature is an inherently social product, but it isn't always commensurate with its public face or accepted manifestations, and the processes of publication aren't always as seamlessly collaborative as literary scholars sometimes imagine. Are the sanitized texts of Osip Mandelstam presented by Soviet editors to be accepted on the grounds that they are collaborative products? Reclaiming works of literature from the censorship they were subject to, often for the duration of their authors' lifetimes, is not a romantic endeavor, but rather an effort to reveal the social antagonisms and broader political forces shaping their accepted social face. General Introduction. The remains of Oscar Wilde lie in Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris. His sleek, modern tomb, designed by the British sculptor Jacob Epstein and commissioned by Wilde's lover and executor Robert Ross, is one of the most frequently visited and recognizable graves in a cemetery notable for the many famous writers, artists, and musicians buried there: Balzac, Chopin, Proust, Gertrude Stein, Jim Morrison. The surface of Epstein's massive monolith is covered with hundreds of lipstick kisses, some ancient and faded, others new and vibrant. "The madness of kissing is what Wilde said Lord Alfred Douglas's red rose-leaf lips were made for." Some observers decry the presence of these marks on Wilde's tomb as a form of defacement or vandalism, rightly pointing out that the lipstick's high fat content does real and lasting damage to the monolith. But to the many men and women, gay and straight, who journey each year to the site, the kisses are a tribute to the famous playwright, novelist, and wit. Sentenced in 1895 to 2 years in prison with hard labor after being convicted of gross indecency, whom they see as a martyr to Victorian sexual morality. 5 years before his death, Wilde went, almost overnight, from being one of Britain's most colorful and celebrated figures to its most notorious sexual criminal. When he died from cerebral meningitis in a seedy Parisian hotel room on November 30, 1900, at the age of 46, he had been living in exile in France for over 3 years. Broken in spirit and body, bankrupt, and ostracized from respectable British society. In 1895, at the time of his arrest, he had been Britain's leading playwright and wit, feted in London's West End and intellectual circles, as well as in the country homes and London townhouses of England's ruling class, much of it unaware that Wilde originated from Ireland, since, to use Wilde's own words, "my Irish accent was one of the many things I forgot at Oxford." Even before his fame as a playwright and novelist, he had been the principal spokesman for the cult of aestheticism, or art for art's sake, which had swept much of England and America in the wake of Wilde's stunning arrival on the cultural scene in 1881. His death in 1900, little more than 3 years after his release from England's Reading prison, the Reading jail of his celebrated poem, The Ballad of Reading Jail, coincided with the end of a decade, the Yellow 90s, the age of Dorian, more closely associated with him than with anyone else, as much for his large personality and life as for his considerable accomplishments as a writer and thinker. Wilde's final years make for a depressing summary. In exile, he took the assumed name of Sebastian Melmoth, invoking the martyrdom of Saint Sebastian, a homosexual icon, and the eponymous protagonist of Melmoth the Wanderer, a Gothic novel by Charles Maturin, Wilde's great uncle. His wife, Constance, who had visited him just once while he was in jail in 1896 to break the news of his mother's death, shunned him in his final years before her own premature death in 1898. After his incarceration, Wilde never again saw his two sons. Like their mother, they had adopted the last name of Holland, and they were taught by Constance and her relatives to forget that we had ever borne the name of Wilde and never to mention it to anyone. 4 months after his release from prison, Wilde returned briefly to his lover Lord Alfred Douglas, who had barely escaped prosecution himself in 1895. Wilde was convinced that with Douglas he could find the happiness, love, and renewed creativity that he craved. But after a 2 month sojourn together in Naples, Douglas abandoned him, leaving Wilde to face his impecunious, uncertain future alone. Harsh prison conditions had taken their toll on Wilde. Isolated and demoralized, he let himself go in the final months of his life. "I will never outlive the century," Wilde predicted. "The English people would not stand for it." Richard Ellman, Wilde's biographer, estimates that he was bedridden by the end of September 1900. On his deathbed, Wilde, who was unable to speak, assented to be received into the Catholic Church by raising his hand and was administered last rites. According to Ellman, Robert Ross, present at Wilde's deathbed, admitted later that he only made up his mind to get Wilde a priest so there could be formal obsequies and a ceremonial burial. Otherwise, Ross feared, the body might be taken to the morgue and an autopsy performed. "The coffin was cheap and the hearse was shabby," Ellman states succinctly. According to the writer Ernest Lejeune,
sample complete. Ready to continue?